Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming out on this beautiful, finally, some sun in the air in the Boston Metro here. Although I guess there was a bad traffic accident out on Route 9 and 495, which seems to be kind of a recurring thing these days in the area with trucks tipping over, knocking out bridges and stuff like that. So this is the third one that I'm aware of in the last few weeks. So hopefully, you know, as they say, things come in three, and that'll be the end of it. We'll have a good summer and no big traffic tie-ups, except if you're going up to the beach or someplace out to the Cape. Anyhow, thanks again for coming out. My name is Bob Zurich. I'm with IBM, and I'm one of the co-leaders with Dan Bricklin on the open source special interest group for the Mass Technology Council, Technology Leadership Council. And we're excited to bring together the forum of speakers that we have, which we'll have them introduce themselves. A couple of logistic things. Our sponsor today is Choate Hall and Stewart, and Karen Copenhaver is here, and she'll be saying a few comments and make some observations after the panel today. So thank you very much for sponsorship. And then also we'd like to thank Schwartz Communications for the facilities today, which are wonderful. So we really appreciate it. And Ross is here, and you can all shake his hand afterwards. And thanks. I appreciate that. And also we want to encourage your involvement with the council. There's a lot of great upcoming events that you should look at on the calendar. Particularly the SOA, service-oriented architecture, that will take a real in-depth look from a business perspective. So we have leaders that are pursuing SOA strategies in organizations in different verticals, whether it be healthcare or retail, that we're going to bring together. And then we'll have a conversation panel and then breakout sessions based on those people that are interested in and Judy Hurwitz is leading that effort with a number of people. Any other logistic things that I'm thinking about? I always do this, and it's just my nature when I'm hosting at a facility, is let you know where the exits are. So when you go out of here, the quickest way to get to the exit is to the left in case there's a situation. And then the other exit is all the way back to where the elevator is. So I know which way I'm going. Do you guys and gals know which way you're going? So out and to the left. And hopefully no earthquakes or anything like that. Well, otherwise, jump under the table, and there's quite a few. The pool table looks pretty good, so that's pretty heavy duty. So without further ado, what I'd like to do is this session, it was really brought together to have some of the leading proprietary, what some now may say, hybrid software companies with both proprietary and open source views to discuss, debate, talk about the issues, talk about the views, companies pursuing in this world of open source. And it's just a constant tone of buzz in the industry about open source, and there's all kinds of opinions about, you know, what's going on, what's likely to happen. And so we went out and selectively chose what we feel are representative leaders, and this is a really unique opportunity, I believe, to really have take some time to ask questions, to explore the conversation around or the topic around open source. So again, take advantage of it. We want this session to be extremely interactive. Dan will be firing off questions if you don't ask questions, but I would encourage you to ask questions as much as you can. Or Dan may reach out, as he does sometimes, and puts his microphone in your face and says, "What do you think about this?" You know. So we'll leave it at that. So the format will be: we'll do some introductions, some general statements up front. We'll go into the interactive session. We'll take a break. We'll come back for some conclusions, and Karen will make some observations based on her rich experience in this area. And then we'll go from there. So Omar, would you like to start on the introduction?
I thought it was ladies first.
Okay.
I'm just trying to be a gentleman here.
Thank you.
Okay. Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So I'm not sure what am I supposed to say here. I'm Omar Tazi. I'm chief open source evangelist at Oracle. A lot of people tell me, you know, how come Oracle and open source is on the same business card? What is Oracle really doing with open source? And the reality is, and I hope after today's panel, you understand what Oracle does with open source and why we're engaged in so many open source projects and so forth. I tend to be on the road quite a bit for my evangelism side of things and talk about, you know, the projects we're involved in and see if people are interested in joining some of them and build communities around the efforts that we're either leading or joining or believe in. I also deal quite a bit with strategy, open source projects that we consume, open source projects that we start, pieces of IP that we can open source, deal a lot with legal issues and, you know, development managers who do not necessarily want their, you know, piece of software to be out in the open. And so that's kind of my role at Oracle. One observation, I'm sure, you know, we can talk about all the what we believe in and where we see open source, you know, going, moving forward and so forth after we get all the questions from the audience and from Dan. But I'm not sure the opposite of open source is proprietary companies or vendors, because I mean it's I'm never really sure what the opposite of open source is. Is it closed source? That's kind of ugly, you know. Is it, you know, commercial software? Maybe, but certainly not proprietary, because the I think the opposite of proprietary of, you know, is basically open standards, not open source. So that's something that we also believe in, is that choice comes from open standards, not necessarily from open source. A lot of open source projects didn't start as JSRs or as standards, W3C standards or anything. In fact, they became de facto standards, like Struts is a good example, which started as a, you know, small servlet and became this de facto standard for building MVC applications. But so that's just an observation, because I see a lot of, you know, instances of the word proprietary being used as non-open source, but I think proprietary is non-open standards. That's just my observation. Thanks.
I'm Bob Sutor. I'm IBM's Vice President for Standards and Open Source. I'm first person ever to have that title in IBM. And I got it at the beginning of 2005. It's a corporate level position, which I think in some sense shows the importance of open source, indeed standards, to the company. We probably have about half a dozen vice presidents who somehow are squeezing open source into their titles at this point. More seem to be popping up all the time, and that's fine. You know, there's no one open source guy in IBM other than maybe Sam Palmisano, right? And he, in fact, does talk about it quite a bit. My responsibilities are really, I mean, like anyone else here, both internal and external. I manage a lot of the way we deal with cross-unit open source issues inside the company, how we deal with licensing issues, how we deal strategically with things that may be of interest to one business unit that may be in the opposite interests of another business unit, right? When you've got hardware and software and services, how do you make them all work together? How do you let them do their own thing versus how do you keep consistent about this? One of the things we've learned, for example, a lot of our open source experience going way back to about 1998 came out of Linux. That was very closely related to our hardware, a little bit later software, directly software, things like Eclipse, many other projects. And then we've got this little thing called IBM Global Services, right, which is actually more than half the company. Well, you know, if you come from a software view of the world, open source in services is a very different type of world. Right, you create software, you send out 1,000, you know, 10,000 copies of the thing. Whereas in services, you're looking at 10,000 different engagements that all may use the open source software and may do it in a slightly different way and might get mixed with other things in different ways. So we very much live this life of, to get back to, you know, Omar's point, we're, and Bob originally, you know, we're not a proprietary company. We're not an open source company. You could call us hybrid at this point. It depends on what part of the business you are talking with. Now, my standard, my title, excuse me, is actually two parts. There's the standards part as well. Standards, of course, is different from open source. It annoys me no end that every single day you read an article that confuses standards and open source. So I have a personal goal of meeting every one of those people and correcting them. Right? I'm smiling. You can't tell that in the podcast. But they are related. And it, you know, more generally, inside IBM, we talk about this open movement. We talk about open standards and open source and open architectures. We relate this very much to service-oriented architecture. We think service-oriented architecture will only work if there's a tremendous amount of openness related to it. We think that service-oriented architecture will only work if people move away from their view of intellectual property the way we had it, let's say, 10 years ago, around how to actually get software interoperability. When you see certain people talking about, well, yes, we can get interoperability via trade secrets and you know, private contracts and things like this, it's like, wow, you know, 95 or even worse, 85, 1985. It's the old way of doing things. So a little bit strange for IBM, maybe, if you think about it. We're actually extremely aggressive here, both in our adoption, our use, and our experimentation with standards and open source, but also to the way that we've engaged with our customers, increasingly our partners, and especially governments around the world. A lot in Massachusetts. I spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill, you know, the Capitol last year.
Beacon Hill.
Thank you. Beacon Hill. I show the picture of the Gold Dome everywhere I go.
Say oops.
Oops. No, you don't have to say oops. So it's been fascinating, but it's openness in general, and IBM has embraced it. But we're learning a lot as we go along.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Karen Teagan-Padir, and I have a different role from Bob and Omar. I am Vice President of Engineering for our Enterprise Java Platform Group at Sun Microsystems. So my role is very much internally focused on actually delivering all that makes up our complete software stack called the Java Enterprise System. Within my organization, I'm also responsible for the Java Enterprise Edition platform that comes out of our Java community process, and it was interesting to hear the comments about open source versus open standards. Sun Microsystems actually donated one of the largest pieces of code ever when we, at the very beginning of the Java process, when we put our JSP and servlet engine, which you know it today as Tomcat, into the Apache Foundation. And so my team actually built that, and there were some engineers in the group that were, you know, kept coming into my office, we got to do this, we got to open source it. And I remember thinking, you know, why would we want to do that, right? Isn't our value in creating the bits, right? And so it's interesting to see as the market has evolved, as we have changed over time. You know, now I actually, if you read my bio, I took a year off from Sun and went and worked at Red Hat and have returned because I got so passionate about open source and how I believe that that is the better development model. And it's not just a license, right? So when you make the distinction between open source being a license, but open standards being the standard that people are able to implement to, and they can do it in proprietary ways if they would like to. But it's really about developing communities, right? None of our three companies here will be able to employ the smartest people on the planet. It's not going to happen. They're not going to wear, every single smart person on the planet is not going to wear a Sun or Oracle or IBM badge. But if we create these communities and environments where the smartest people on the planet can collaborate, you will see the advent of much greater technology. And so that's really what I've personally have become passionate about over the years. It's interesting because I remember I was definitely one of those engineering managers that thought, you know, my value is in creating software that Sun Microsystems then goes and sells. So coming to a point in time where we have said, and Sun has done this, we are open sourcing everything in our portfolio, absolutely everything. In October, we announced our Solaris Enterprise System, which is the Solaris plus everything above it, including storage software. That's all going to become open source. All of our software will be open source, and we recently announced the OpenSpark.org initiative, becoming the first company to actually open source our hardware implementations as well. So it's been an incredible journey and interesting to watch how the market has evolved and changed over the years.
Just to follow up on that, could you go further into the Tomcat experience? How has that helped you? How long has it been, and has it? What has it actually done for Sun? And what has it done for the rest of the world?
Okay. So it's actually an example of learning for Sun, I would say, in terms of how many of you have heard of Tomcat, right? So almost everyone. How many of you knew that Sun donated the original code for Tomcat? Oh, surprisingly,
this
a quarter.
This is an unusual group.
So I tell that story on a lot of keynotes and stuff that I give, and, I ask the audience, and no one knew that. So it wasn't to make better Sun, right? It was to put together a platform that everybody would use and adopt. And so Java was very much like that too, right? Everybody thought we were absolutely insane when we developed Java and just gave it away for free. You could download it free on the web. Everyone could write their Java. I remember, people, I was so excited about Java. I'd been at Sun for 13 years, and I was so excited about Java, I moved to the Java group just because I had to get a piece of that. What was happening there? It was just so exciting at the time. And everybody kept asking me, well, how are you going to make money on Java? How are you going to make money on Java? And sadly, we still get asked that question, right? It's not about Sun making money on that particular thing. It is about creating a platform and environment across the globe so that everybody can participate. I thought it was going to be a fire alarm. I'm like, good thing you told us where the exits were. So in terms of Tomcat, what we really learned about was about the Apache community, their license, committing status.
So what have you learned? What did you learn in those things?
That open source is not about a license, how you can get lots of other people to contribute back. And now if you look at the Tomcat code, there's a lower percentage of Sun Microsystems committers than there were in the past. Another thing that we learned is as people leave Sun, and if you're a committer in a particular community like Apache, so some of the original folks that wrote that JSP and servlet code don't work at Sun anymore, but they're still committers, still very active in that community.
So you keep employees even after they leave?
Well, how many? I would argue that. I would argue that more people on the planet are using the Apache web server, which has the Tomcat container, than the Sun Microsystems customers. Okay? So it's not a, I don't want people to walk away thinking we did Apache so that Sun could generate revenue. We did the Tomcat donation. It was not about that.
And why was that good for Sun? And it was good for Sun because?
It's really about developers and getting folks to be writing to this different platform. And ultimately, IBM, we are a hardware company, and we have machines that the Tomcat and the Apache web server runs best on our hardware.
So it's been, developers are what it's at?
Developers are key to our strategy going forward, yes.
And that's been successful with Tomcat?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. We have some other questions. Oh, let me put my thing up here.
Could I say something?
Oh, yes.
So it's interesting you say IBM's a hardware company. Microsoft calls us a services company. And, we used to make helicopters, too, a long time ago. As I said in the introduction, one of the things we very much have to deal with is open source from all these different angles. I mean, Linux has been extremely important to IBM from a hardware perspective. because you know, we like to talk about this great heterogeneous world with all this different hardware, you know, be it Spark or whatever. Just forgetting everyone else for a while, IBM had three different lines of hardware by itself, right, with different operating systems and things like this. So Linux, the mainframes, we had the what was the AS400, we had the Intel base as well as the AIX. They have letters, the I series, the P series, the Z series, and so forth, things like this. So we had four lines. We've done a lot to bring the hardware together, you know, technically, in terms of semiconductors, but all by ourselves, having an operating system that ran across all the different hardware was very attractive. Because early on, we developed a model for interoperability that said you could do this at lots of different levels. So Java, of course, was a very, very important part of that, but it was much higher up in the stack. So at the lowest level, there was the aspect of, well, you know, if everyone's running the same operating system, that's pretty good. It's not perfect. You can't pick up code and just drop it, though, again, there's been a lot of progress there with the help of the open source community. There was Java there from a programming perspective. We had XML. We had web services on top of that and so forth. And then somewhere in the picture, we stuck in, for us, Eclipse as something that you could build on Linux or Windows.
That's
right?
Developers again.
That's right.
Sounds like we're starting to hear the ghost of Ballmer here, of Microsoft Steve Ballmer. Developers. How's that?
Well, it was, you know, we're just talking from that angle, but I mean, the business perspective of this is saying, well, can we help make your systems work together? Can we lower your development costs? Can we help you? And this gets back to more on the standard side. Can we help you make all these different systems coming from different people work together? So we bought in very early, I mean, with Sun, with Java. In fact, if you look back the history of IBM just in the last 20 years or so, we did things in the 80s, which we believe we see other people doing right now in terms of believing then that IBM was the center of the universe. And thou shalt only use IBM software and hardware and things like this. This works so well. Look at the early 90s for IBM, right? We had a little bit of a hiccup. We had new senior management come in. We started opening up some of the blueprints for the hardware back then. But really, I think the first significant thing was the partnership with Sun around Java that really represented a change. And then Linux a couple of years later, web services with Microsoft on the other side, which people yelled at us about, but yeah. But it's this constant change, and I think getting back to the notion of the community, you flow as you go through the years. You know, you work with the partners that are relevant. We used to think of community in terms of who are the other corporations we will work with. We don't just think that way anymore. We can't just think. Open source has established that. So we look at who are the really smart people wherever they may live and for whomever they may work that we should work with. And that's what's changing. It's changing the culture of IBM. It's changing the nature of the technology we create as well. And we've had to adapt. I mean, just as you kept saying, you know, how has it changed? Early on in our Linux experience, you know, we would show up and say, here, put this in Linux. And they would say, no, thank you. And we'd say, but we're IBM. And they'd say, really, no, thank you, okay?
They, you know, committers.
The committers there. Yeah, and that is we had to learn to basically saying it's not who you are by virtue of your title or your company, it's the quality of the code, right? And so we're still learning that, but we have a lot of experience there. And I guess one of the big things we continue to learn, try to figure it out, is IBM is so big. I mean, we're over 300,000 people. You know, I sometimes refer to us as a country, you know, almost like in terms of moving. But we're so big that we examine saying, well, how should open source community and develop methods affect what we do just inside IBM? Getting back to the Linux helping our hardware. That we have enough gravity, if you will, that all these other things that you may hear about being wonderful about open source are affecting fundamentally the way we run our company, the way we think about intellectual property, yes, the way we do development, but physically the software we use to run the company as well.
So how has it changed what you've done internally?
It's changed the development process. We have about 1,000 people, developers plus or minus, who work full-time on open source. So part of the model, getting back to Karen, what you were saying about, you know, owning the bits and selling the, you know, licensing the bits, is understanding, saying we will pay these people, but we ourselves will not exclusively be able to use what they create. So 1,000 developers is a lot of money every year.
But it's 1,000 out of 300,000 people. Out of how many developers?
I don't know, double digits. I don't know the right number. Exactly the right number. I mean, let's say 50,000. That's the right order of magnitude.
Okay, so we're talking about a few percent of your developers, only a couple
But I'm saying full time.
Right.
So those are just
full time.
There are lots of other people, I don't know the number, who work part time
on
this. But it's enough of a percentage, right? And they're not slouches either, for that matter, right? I mean, they're some of our very best developers.
So you're saying that a very small percentage are working on open source. But that has been key to the entire operation, which is mainly either proprietary or custom development.
I would argue that's not a small percentage. No. So first of all, it's a lot of people. It's a lot. I mean, how many companies here have 1,000?
In absolute numbers, it's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. But again, I mean, that's my number for full time, not.
I'm looking for yardsticks to look at other companies, where it sort of says, like, if you're a small company, maybe one or two developers being full-time open source can have a large effect. I mean, this is what I'm hearing.
Oh, they absolutely do. And there are also people who are developers but are also leaders in the community. We as well have leaders in Apache. I mean, Omar, you've folks as well who go out there. So there's a combination of things. You have people who write code, but you also have people who influence the direction of these different organizations. It's affected us internally by looking at our development practices and saying, should we do open source strictly internally? And by that I mean, you know, we used to have a very siloed view of, well, these are the database people. They write database code. Well, do they develop algorithms and write Java code that should be used in WebSphere or Tivoli? How do you make that happen? How do you break away from the typical internal company hierarchy? You know, developer reports to a manager, reports to another manager, and things like this. How do you cut across those lines where it becomes more of a technical meritocracy while still somehow preserving some, you know, level of company structure and things like this? So it's offered new ways of identifying good people, pressures in other ways of fitting them, paying them the right way. I mean, all these sorts of things.
So, can I just jump in? I wanted to mention about what Bob was saying triggered something in my mind. One of the big things that you have to look at as you change into more open source development is when you typically are creating a piece of software, you have your source code and it's inside your firewall. Nobody can see it. The engineers are, you know, basically free to write whatever they want in their comments, like, this code stinks, a little stronger language. When we decided to do some things completely outside the firewall, like Open Solaris, Open Java EE, we just announced, although that project under the project name Glassfish has been going on for a while. You put the code on the other side of the firewall, and then you actually take your builds and you bring that in and you test it and stabilize that. So it's completely opposite in the way that people had traditionally done this in the past. It's much harder because what happens is, as you have all the eyes on the world, anybody's free to go look at the code, and in true open source development, projects can make changes, make suggestions. So sometimes it takes longer because people will come back with different. I remember saying to my engineers, but we have a deadline. We're shipping. And they're like, but it's not done. And I said, well, just do less. Make it, you know, stop. You know, let's stabilize what we have now. Don't do those new features. But it's on the other side of the firewall, and the world is telling us we have to do A, B, and C before it's done. Which it's very hard for us traditional engineering managers to kind of wrap our heads around that, right? And to have to go back to the executive management team and say, this is what I think the schedule is going to be like, but, you know, here are some more variables that you have to consider.
So is this giving you a different type of discipline?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So it's one that is not the discipline of marketing from a market to a date.
Correct.
But what discipline, you said about comments and stuff like, what type of discipline have you guys found, has it changed for your developers? Mm-hmm. And does it flow to other products?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that IBM is the reason we have, you know, things like Eclipse, and the reason why we have a better Linux, and Oracle is one other reason, and Sun is also a reason why we have. So even if the 1,000 seems like a small number, they're one of the companies that contribute the most to the open source world, and they're doing an awesome job there. So that's something that we have to recognize. And it's not a small, you know, percentage, or, you know, it's because the 1,000 people who are working full time, there's people who are not working full time, and then there's people who are joining these projects that are started by IBM, which are, you know, like Eclipse today, of course, primarily, you know, led by IBM, but there's a ton of people joining and developing. So that's, you know, maybe a few hundred that bring another, you know, few thousand, and it's snowballs,
so
basically.
It's an enormous leverage even to a big company with 300,000 people.
I think it's one of the companies that are making the most impact on the open source world. So that's one thing. As far as open source, for Oracle, I mean, we don't think it's a good or a bad thing. We think it's just a different way of building software, developing software, distributing software, and new way of, you know, maybe monetizing software as well. Business models are being created every day around open source. You see VCs investing in new open source based companies every day. In the Valley, you know, if you have open source in your slides, you probably increased your chances to raise money, you know, by a few folds. So it's like a hot buzzword, just like you hear Ajax or Web 2.0. So open source these days happens to be a sexy word when it comes to raising money. So the way we look at, I mean, we're learning a lot as well. I mean, in terms of development discipline, I mean, it was surprising to some of our developers when we said that when we donate things like ADF Faces, which is Java Server Faces based, and more than 100 components that are reusable when you build user interface for your J2EE applications, or now Java EE applications, you use those components to build your pages. So we donated that to Apache under the My Faces project. Still in incubation, but those are details. But the point I'm trying to make is these guys were doing things internally. All of a sudden, they have to open the kimono and put that code in Subversion, in the Apache Software Foundation Subversion repository. And that's our source of truth. So basically, when we need something internally, we are going to pull it from that repository. We're not going to pull it from our internal repositories behind our firewalls. We get it from there. You know, we add, you know, things to it and test it and maybe have a different build, documentation, whatnot, and then put it in our commercial products. But we develop it in front of everyone using, you know, transparency and, you know, all the whatever practices there are in the open source world. So, for example, collaborative development. You have to get used to people contributing stuff while you're asleep. You wake up, somebody from New Zealand changed something, you know, and using things like, you know, bug tracking, issue tracking, that are different from our internal systems.
It's a trusted person from New Zealand who...
Committers are known.
Committers, right.
Committers
right.
are known.
It's not just some random hacker who did
it. No, but right. a lot of yeah, people right. can, you know, suggest things. You know, they have an issue tracking system. And so it's just a new way of doing things that we learn a lot from. Because, believe it or not, it makes software more robust. You have, all of a sudden, thousands of people who are testing your software out there. They're not QA people that are in your payroll, but they're doing a lot of testing for you, for the community, not really for you. But and so that piece of software is more robust for some reason, and we have to learn why. And we're learning a lot. So it's pretty interesting, and it's different.
So I just want to say one thing. It's obviously missing here is we don't have somebody from Microsoft, which is another large company. They were invited. They were sending somebody who was flying in for it, but at the last minute, canceled, I think last week or something. So we were going to have some equivalent or whatever, you know, somebody with the title open source or something in their name here from Microsoft. But unfortunately, they pulled out and did give us somebody in return. So
yeah, we originally had Ray Ozzie scheduled.
Yeah, and Ray Ozzie we were trying to get, but then his schedule didn't work out. But we'll work that out at some point in the future. But he'll listen to this. You know, that's, you know, he seems to... He pays attention to what's going on around here. So I hear all this nice, good kumbaya stuff here about how wonderful, you know, how we Oracle and IBM are working together, you know, and then, you know, and the Sun is doing. So
where's the competition here? How are you, because you're fierce competitive companies here. How does that stay, how do you still have that despite the fact that your key people are not in your company, and some of them are at your competitors, and that you are working together, you have some commonality in it. Where's the competition still there?
Yeah, maybe I can, yeah. So as I said earlier, we don't see open source as good or bad or as something that's going to kill all you know, software vendors or, you know, this chaos or whatever. We see it as I said, new development model, new business models are created every day based on, you know, maintenance, support, whatnot. We see it as something that we need to leverage, something that's here to stay, something that we need to work with. And we see it as, you know, actually, for example, let me just give you a few examples. When it comes to development tools, things that are commoditized, like development tools, operating systems, we love Linux. So I'll show you why we love Linux. It's not because it's great.
To you, it's a commodity. To those of us who develop tools, of course, it's our lifeblood. But yes, okay.
Sure. But good luck trying to, you know, build billion-dollar companies with tools. But it's, we're talking here IBM and Oracle and people who, you know. But anyways, what I'm trying to say here is that, and I'm sorry for the tools. what I'm trying to say is that we don't do open source because it's cool. We are a software company. You know, unlike IBM or Sun, which have other sources of revenue, we are a software company, right? So at the end of the day, we need to sell software. So if everything tomorrow was open sourced from everyone in the world, and you take it to the extreme where all developers are working for free in this la-la land, and we're screwed, basically. So
the developers don't work for free. They get paid by somebody.
That's true, but right. That somebody only pays them because they make money.
They make money,
and
right.
We pay a lot of developers to work on open source because we sell software. So that's something to keep in mind. So we don't do open source typically because it's cool or because it's a Me Too move because IBM or Novell or Sun is doing open source. We do it for very specific business reasons, and that you have to keep in mind. For example, Linux, we love Linux because we own more than 80% of the database sales on top of Linux. We sell, you know, we're number one and by very, very far. So we love Linux. So we're trying to make Linux better. Right, so and we help IBM and other people in the community work on Linux, right? So that's one reason. We tend to get behind technologies that we have invested in and that we believe in strongly. EJB3O is a very good example. JSF, Java Server Faces, is a good example. So if we want these technologies to be around and work with Sun on making these things, you know, stronger and stronger, we need to provide tools and components and reusable components for people to use and make sure they don't go into, you know, competing, you know, technologies like the Microsoft offering or stack, for example. So we will provide Eclipse plugins for EJB3O. We'll provide a lead and co-lead with other companies plugins for, you know, Java Server Faces and BIPL and all those technologies and standards that we believe in to make sure we'll get behind those things to make sure they're around, you know, because our stack basically uses those things and leverages those standards and technologies. So we don't want those technologies to be used only by Oracle. The best way to make those technologies, you know, mainstream and used by, you know, masses of people is to produce, you know, useful tools and help people actually lower the barrier to entry, basically. So just to say that, you know, if you notice, when we get behind an open source project or we start an open source project, it's for a business reason. And we still like to make money with software. And it's not good or bad. It's something that we leverage to actually get to our goals. So it's just to
and
be
it's
blunt
been
about it.
It's been working.
It's been working very well.
Yeah. Do you want to slide that down?
Sorry. Oh, we should maybe just unplug this thing right here and just hand it over.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Careful about handling noise. Don't hold it too close. That's
okay,
it.
Okay, how's fine. That?
Yeah, it's great.
I'll try not to move. So you asked a very pointed question about competition between the partners. So 2 points. One, you know, it really is a big kumbaya. It is. Our engineers spend, in these three companies, EJB3O is a perfect example where the engineers at Sun and IBM and BEA and Oracle all got together to actually develop the technology that is the right technology. And none of us could go in to our engineer's office and tell them they have to do something this way because we're paying your paycheck. Those days are over. We might have liked them as, you know, managers in control, but it's not how you develop software anymore. So it is the big kumbaya. The other thing is community drives demand for back-end infrastructure, right? So we are all represent companies that sell infrastructure to support these growing communities, right? Where do you think all of your iPod, your file sharing, Skype, eBay, Amazon, all of these companies that are creating demand for servers, for software, for services, for databases. It's becoming because we have this kind of open community and driving more folks to the network. And that happened because the engineers at all the various companies and the developers got together to create the technology to make it all possible.
So there's a virtuous circle here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, would you guys agree?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we still compete. Yeah. We still work in many different ways.
An interesting example would be WebSphere versus Tomcat and JBoss and stuff like that.
Right. Right. So, in fact, I was... You were asking about some of the industry dynamics and things like this. So first of all, this is a very fast-moving industry. I mean, you really have to. So anyone who sort of goes back and says, well, we used to do this 5 years ago, therefore we should keep doing it, is just a dinosaur. Yeah, just and it's probably a lot closer than 5 years, frankly. So there was a lot going on. I mean, we've been very involved with Apache for a long time with XML parsers and Apache itself and things like this. We made a decision actually in the 90s, the late 90s, that we would drop our own proprietary web servers because it was stupid to just keep putting people on this when, you know, it was very good at the time and still has about 70% of the market share and things like this. So there's been a lot of interesting things going on in the Java world. I mean, there's been debates about open sourcing Java or things above Java, or here or there, app servers, or whatever else. Certainly JBoss came up quite a bit in the last few years. I mean, that's just numbers. You know, you can see the numbers. And there were other factors that sort of affected this. I remember being in one meeting where people were talking about JBoss in particular application, and these specific developers were saying, yeah, but we just like using JBoss. It's sort of like we like being part of that community. You know, we like being. So this was not what the business people or the CIO was telling them necessarily to do, but it was a changing cultural issue, right, which we all as let me say commercial companies had to deal with in some way. So when we purchased GlueCode, which provides support for Geronimo, and we now provide what's called WebSphere Community Edition, right? So you can download it for free. We have, as well as Oracle, a database you can download for free as well. So that changed the dynamics of the market around open source web application servers. There was Apache Geronimo versus JBoss, and there's even a third one, which is popular in Europe, is Jonas as well. A couple of months ago, in fact, it was completed yesterday, Red Hat buys JBoss. Red Hat's an IBM partner, as with many people, right, and things like this. How does this affect the industry? Well, it does, but you deal with it and you move on. This is going to keep happening in different ways, in different combinations, as people flesh out their portfolios in different ways. You know, we're all big enough that the types of customers we have come, you know, small to large, in little departments, big departments, governments, distributed organizations, centralized organizations. That is, we have one of everybody. And so our goal to continue to remain profitable and generate money from this one way or another is to give our customers something that they will pay for, right? That's business. We give them something, whatever. Now, the something will change. And if you're stuck on the old, the something has to be the way we always used to do it, good luck. You know, maybe you'll keep doing well, you'll generate some money for a while, but if you just keep thinking it's got to remain the same thing, well, whatever. So the trick is to get out in front of that and to come up with the right combination, because it is not strictly open source. It's not strictly proprietary. It's some sort of mix. One of the things that, we've discovered is that even though we give away a free version of DB2, so it is free, people, turns out, are very comfortable with using that with other open, with open source. So it's not open source, but it's free. And for certain people, this combination of open source, free, whether freedom or beer, whatever you want to think of, with free and cost for the other thing, it's just cool with them. They like that. So we're learning about what are the right mixes of what people want, what they will use, what they ultimately want in terms of support, and where this all works out.
What I hear from all of you, though, is that you haven't mentioned the free as in beer until just now, that all of the benefit and everything you've been talking about is the permeation of the permeating the corporate wall, the fact that the source code is available to all to see and is contributed in a community effort.
Right.
That's been the thing about open source that's been the value. Though that IBM, you said, was the fact that it ran on everything and stuff like that mattered. To Oracle developer, you know, developers, we hear here that it provides all these great tools. It's a platform on which you can run your proprietary stuff. The fact whether or not it's free
commercial
was not
stuff.
You can run your commercial stuff. So we're for the first time you're starting to mention that there is a, some people do care about the money part.
They care about the money, yeah, at times, and it will vary depending on what you're doing. They also care about free terms of intellectual property. And not from the perspective of give me something you have because I want it, right? That's not what they're thinking of. They're thinking about it, can I use this to build something bigger and better, right? Well, a lot of these people are some people coming from more of an academic view of the world here, saying,
use the General Motors and the Fords and
increasingly, okay, that's right. You know, so we did this little experiment at the beginning of 2005.
Hold the mic like this, we have a noisy fan up there.
We'll make it more unidirectional.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so we did this little experiment at the beginning of 2005 where we pledged 500 patents to open source. Right? We said 500 software patents. There were two hardware ones which accidentally snuck in there. But we'll say 500 in round numbers. It's actually a joke at this point. They're two little hardware ones. What we wanted to do was we wanted to shake up people's view around intellectual property and the relationship to classical ways of dealing with it with open source. We wanted to say, look, for a little bit of our portfolio, and we have a lot of patents, so it was still, I'm guessing 500 is more than any individual of you have at the moment. Certainly me.
Is it that 0.2% like the developers, or is it more like?
It's more than, it's not 0.2. You got to do your math
here.
Yeah, it's a lot. But in any case, the point is to fundamentally make people.
In my company, 100% of all the employees work on open source. So
that's right.
But only about 50% of the time. So
well, we can compare revenues too, though. Okay. What we wanted to do was people to examine this notion of saying, is it possible to take something which is developed inside a company in the traditional way and say, here, take this, go crazy, build something on top of it, and come back. And we've gotten some interesting anecdotal response to this, all of which was positive. You know, we never expected people to say, I built this and this and this. We basically just wanted to shake up people and say, it's possible. You can do this. Let's look at it left, right, up, down, and all these different ways. This notion of patent commons became more public. But it just raised the discussion. So in some sense, 2005 was a shake-up year in terms of people's preconceived notions around how these things could work together. So that even that we're all here, with or without Microsoft, talking about open source is representative.
It's very like this. Okay, perfect. So it's very interesting to see why people come to open source. Some people come because they are trying to lower costs. Some people come because they're trying to not be locked in to a vendor's stack, or and my answer to those, to the latter, is basically use open standards. Because open source does not guarantee you that you're not going to be locked in. However, open standards guarantee you that you're not going to be locked in. That's why we religiously adhere to standards today at Oracle. We have something that a lot of people think is a marketing buzzword. It's called hot pluggability, but it's actually something we're spending a lot of engineering time on, which is if you want to use our Bipple engine on top of JBoss, it's going to work as long as both comply with open standards. If you want to use our identity management software and on top of anything that, you know, so you don't have to use the Oracle stack. As Bob said, we have so many accounts, big and small, where you're going to find some IBM, some Sun, some Oracle, so we need to make sure all that stuff works together. So that it's interesting to see how people come to open source. And usually, you know, some people think it's cool because they have access to the source code. And when you ask them how many of you actually look at the source code, you'll be amazed. I mean, people don't really look at the source code. People like Eclipse, they're not going to necessarily, you know, go you know, and change the editor. You know, they just use it because it's free. The barrier to entry is very low. They can just download it, use it, and they have plugins that come out every, you know, so often. They can download the build, you know, risk it, and play with new features. So it's always interesting to see why everyone comes to open source. It's not always the same, you know, reason. And, you know, I hear all kinds of things, and very often they're not really justified. You know, when it comes to, you know, not being locked in, or, you know, lowering the cost, the total cost of ownership sometimes of using all these pieces of open source and trying to integrate them is much higher than getting an integrated stack from IBM or from Oracle and getting, you know, one throat to choke, getting one 800 number to call. So, you know, a lot of people come to open source and don't know really why. The cool effect is playing a big role. A lot of people also came to open source because they were unemployed after September 11, and they wanted something on their resume. It looks bad to say, okay, we're from 2000 to 2002, I didn't do anything. So they're like, oh no, I was a committer on this, and I was a committer on that, and you know, it makes it all of a sudden look much more valuable to whoever is gonna, you know. So it's interesting to see how many people come to open source for
that's
cost
only
reduction.
That's people as individuals as opposed to corporations, though.
Sure, but you know, even corporations, they have different reasons why they get behind an open source project or another. So
we're starting to get finally the audience is starting to warm up here, and it's coming up on an hour, so maybe we should see if any questions from the audience. I see one over there. We'll start one. Just say who you are and what your company does, or something, and then.
My name is Peter Winston, and I guess I'm an open source application developer. Company's called Project.net, and I'm all for open standards, okay? And I'm all for, and I agree with you that in many cases, you might even have a better throat to choke by buying a commercial application. But it's hardly the same to try to substitute open standards for open source. They're vastly different in the philosophy of what the person's buying. I mean, you don't see the buy-in of Brazil into we want to use Oracle's open standards, because it isn't just about what's the cheapest today. It's about putting yourself into a business model and into a philosophy that you think is going to be the best long term for your organization. And so I, instead of asking a question, wanted to strongly disagree.
So when we talk to governments, and just this last week, at the end of last week, Denmark voted unanimously, actually, in their parliament, to require open standards, and not pseudo open standards or slightly, just honest to goodness, real open standards, starting in 2008. We're starting to see more and more of this. A lot of governments got themselves in trouble, in particular because of all the lobbyists showing up from a certain place whenever this open word was mentioned, when they started to try to lead with an open source message. But in fact, as they've understood this more and have in fact separated open source from open standards, they've realized that going with open standards is a smart choice anyway. I mean, it's just very hard to fight against this notion of interoperability via open standards. But then they eventually get to the question of saying, well, how do we actually implement this? Right. And that's where open source should come in. How do we actually implement this? It's being driven in part by service-oriented architecture. As we're pulling apart these different things into services, you must have open standards to connect things together, the way you represent the information, the way the protocols you carry it. And then when you build the thing, build it any way you want. If you want to use your open source application, that's great. If you want to use pure commercial IBM stuff, that's fine. If you want to use our stuff running on Sun hardware, do whatever. Okay, but there's a mix. So what we have seen is that with standards and indeed open source, is we're able to offer customers a lot more choice than we used to be able to.
So I don't think any of us are trying to say that go get your open source thing off the shelf and go deploy it, right? Ultimately, you're solving a business problem or you're solving a consumer problem, whatever technology problem you're trying to solve, then we find that developers or end users go look, well, is there something, you know, they Google it now. Is there something free that I can use? And if the answer is yes, great. Is it open source? Better. Is it implementing an open standard? Even better. The JBost example that Bob just gave was, a perfect one. The people liked using JBost because it was open source, because it was a good product, it was free, and it was open source, and it implemented an open standard of J2EE that allowed their applications to that they could develop, test, deploy on the JBoss application server, and then not get locked in. They'd know that their application would run on my application server from Sun, on IBM's application server, and on Oracle's application server. So we're not trying to say that, you know, open source is the nirvana and it solves every problem, but it is, you know, again, back to the community and a way of actually developing product and technology that ultimately solve your business need. If there's technology out there that's open source that doesn't solve a problem for you, it's not going to do well in the community and in the marketplace.
Yeah. Again, what I tend to work with our customers on is basically their open source strategy. And what I like to suggest to them is what we call open ecosystem or open software. So that's a combination of free software, free as in free beer. I mean, Oracle XE, JDeveloper, other examples of very good products out there that are free. Open standards, smart architecture. Lowering the costs also, if you have a very smart architecture that allows you to be flexible down the road, service orientation is a good example. Grid, scaling up, you know, by throwing commodity hardware at your infrastructure, all those things. So it's open source is just one component of the things we suggest to them. And open standards is the most important component. And then it's open source. So, for example, you're trying to build a SOA, you know, implementation. Some of the things you need are an app server, OS, tools to develop things, UDDI registries, BIPL engines, ESBs, enterprise service buses. So good luck trying to find, or identity management infrastructure, good luck trying to find, you know, a robust BIPL engine or ESB engine. Business process execution language, sorry. So how you orchestrate your web services. Once you, you know, discover them and find them, you need to orchestrate them to describe your business flow. And that's very popular these days. And each and every one of us offers a BIPL engine. So in the open source world, you'll find tools that are open source. You'll find, you know, OS that is open source. You'll find an app server that is open source. But, you know, luckily, vendors are still able to provide, you know, value on top of commodity or on top of, you know, open source or on top of cheap stuff and implement, you know, things that are really scalable, robust, and provide value. And you'll get maybe a BIPL engine from us or from them, and you'll get maybe identity management from us or from another vendor. Until these things become strong enough or good enough in the open source world, you're still going to have to get them from vendors. So to me, it's not just open source or it's a mix of commercial, free, what I call open ecosystem. You know, free as in free beer, standards, and commercial software, and open source. What is what you need to be looking at?
I'm Kent Bradford. I'm from a company called SoftCheck. We build static analysis and testing tools for Java. And I'm curious from when you. One of the fellows from Fidelity who did one of the first open source things talked about not using open source in certain areas because he didn't have a throat to choke. I think that was Bob's quote as well. I'm curious, now that you have, you have all of these different committers who you don't control, and you're running across each other's platforms, Suns, J2EE, so on and so forth. Have you changed your testing models as opposed to the traditional functionality inside the firewall process or code manual code review to try to keep up with that? Because if somebody changes the array specification four classes away on a piece of code you don't control, how do you find that?
I can take So again, I'll come back to that simple Apache project that we started or that we contributed. And basically, our internal testing procedure has not changed, okay? In terms, because at the end of the day, what we do, our developers have had to adapt, right? So their source of truth is that Subversion repository that sits somewhere else, and every now and then we suck, you know, a build into our system, and we integrate it with the rest of our, you know, components, and then our QA team takes over and tests it the same way as if it was developed internally, okay? Once we have developers who are looking at the Subversion, you know, repository, and when a build is stable enough, we suck it in, we use it, with other layers of the stack, right? And it's tested the same way it was tested before. From a testing perspective, it's maybe QA people have less work to do because so many eyeballs looking at, you know, the source code that, you know, it makes all the bugs shallow, I guess is the quote from Linus Torvald. So basically when QA gets that build, they find less issues than, you know, they would typically find if it was just developed internally and tested and looked at internally. I think that's the only change. But our testing, practices have not really, really changed. Development has been impacted, I think, much more than our QA teams.
Just say something about that. Sure. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I would agree with you. So if you look at Eclipse, just something we use quite a bit, we don't simply take Eclipse off the shelf and then somehow put a rational name on top with a few extra things and throw it out the door. We do extra QA of the straight Eclipse. We do a lot of testing of our things with Eclipse. When we internally discover any problems there may be, we then push them back out, right? So it's an additional level that we have of QA inside IBM that's above and beyond what's normally happening in the community. Now, that has changed, though, since it's not the only QA that's happening, and we have these people who are living at the boundary. Right, so they may be getting the errors from somewhere out of left field. That is, they're finding out about them, the bugs. And so it's very much changed the notion of how things are discovered and where potential fixes come from. But we have not abandoned our internal QA simply because we're picking up a piece of open source code.
So I think it has changed how we do testing, just in terms of where you focus the resources. Folks that are downloading something, so, you know, for Java and the Java EE platform, we have millions of downloads. And what are those developers doing with those downloads? And we have, you know, good examples of what blueprints or sample applications they're running, and we get feedback in that way. So my quality engineers don't spend as much time focusing on those surface issues because they do get caught by the community in what we would call a continuous beta, right? So as you develop software outside the firewall in an open source community, you don't wait for, you know, the particular build to be named beta and it's done before people get their hands on it and get to use it. The source code's out there. There are nightly builds, and people go and play with it, and their feedback comes in. So what I do in my organization is we look at, well, where is the feedback coming from the external? And I will shift resources internally so that they're not focused on doing the stuff that the external community is going to see all the time initially. It's interesting to talk about test and how open source really hasn't infiltrated the test arena, and I think it's because it's just not fun, right? So when we donated the servlet, the Tomcat code to the Apache community, we also donated the technology compatibility kit, which is the test suite that makes sure that those implementations actually implement the specifications. And I thought, oh, this is great, because compatibility costs an awful lot of money. We spend most of our effort really in developing these test kits and these test suites. And I said, oh, this would be wonderful if we could get the community to actually start writing the technology compatibility kit for us. Oh, this is just going to be wonderful. Everybody's going to participate. You know, nothing. No, we didn't get one test written. We tried to generate some demand for that community, and, you know, it's just not interesting. So I think it's because, you know, I think the point that Omar was making before, individuals really are developers. They may not be employed. You made a comment earlier about, you know, they're employed by someone. I would say they're not. Many of them aren't. And so those folks are the ones that are developing, you know, new and cool things because they're spending their free time on it. And I would also mention that I bet in all of our companies, I have engineers that spend their daytime working on a project that I ask them to work on because that's what Sun's paying them to do. And they spend their nights developing struts. Actually, Craig McClanahan on my team did that, you know, half-time at night in his free time developing stuff that was of interest to them.
So what I hear is that there's this problem with open source that if the project doesn't, if you don't get the critical mass of developers and testers and users, then that you don't get some of the benefits that you're talking about don't exist.
That's right. Absolutely.
The customers still get certain other benefits, like inexpensive and the source code available for modification, et cetera, et cetera. Correct. But most open source projects are in that category of very few developers, you know, one committer, two committers, something like that. So what's that say? Does that mean you have to market your open source thing to be, I mean, this, here's a case of even Sun with a product that could be widely used. What is it that it takes, and what's the dynamic here about where you have to go proprietary versus open, et cetera?
So I didn't quite get your last comment, but you do have to go and market and evangelize your communities without a doubt. So, you know, we've heard the name Eclipse mentioned all morning, so I cannot get out of here without talking about NetBeans. And NetBeans.org is our project for Sun-sponsored, but lots of developers. We have 300,000 registered users of the NetBeans toolkits and bundles into all of the major application servers and runtimes bundled together, so you can you have an alternative to the Eclipse toolset. But people, many people were telling Sun, abandon NetBeans. You know, Eclipse has won, abandon NetBeans. And we just spent not a lot of money. Basically, we hired a couple of passionate engineers from the NetBeans community and said, go, you know, see if we can get folks to come and look at our stuff. Because if you need people to come and look and play with your technology in order for them to tell two friends, to tell two friends, to tell two friends. And that's how the communities grow. So I'm certain there is really interesting technology out there in some community somewhere that, you know, in 5 or 6 years we will be using and pulling into all of our
What's critical mass? What is critical mass? Mm.
Could I just make it? So I have to be very careful when you talk about it. So I'll return to the notion of the importance of community. But let's also, you know, so let's say I'm on, and unfortunately I'm one of these guys who sometimes codes on weekends. I should be doing other things. So let's just say I as an individual decide, well, I've cooked up this thing in my office. I want to put it out as open source. Should I say, oh, if I don't get a community behind this, I'm a total failure? No, absolutely. Put it out there. You know, because you may not have anything that day or that week, but someone may randomly come across your code and say, you know, this section's exactly what I need. I'm going to take this, not reinvent it, and go on build something big and wonderful. So there's very much of this notion of contributing to the general intellectual library, right? It's what's been happening in academia for years and years and years. There are obscure lemmas and things that eventually become great theorems, you know, when other people see the connection between certain things. So that's important. Now, that said, from a corporate perspective of when we decide to actively engage in an open source project, we absolutely look at community. Because otherwise, we say, is it just IBM putting code out there for people to see? Are we going to be the only people working on it? What is the real value, if any, to that? So community is very important. I tend to think of community playing off control, right? So if we want to control something, you may not get the biggest community, right? If there's a big community, you have less control. And there's some sort of sliding scale there, which is important at any particular time for any particular project. So that's remember. And the only other thing I want to add there is the nature of the project can often determine the type of community you build. If it's something like a NetBeans or an Eclipse or some of the other things like Sugar CRM that have a plug-in architecture that let people say, I don't want to change the base, but I want to build lots of things that work with it, community will often grow very large.
Yeah, from a corporate perspective, I don't think it makes any sense that, you know, we open source something and no one looks at it. The goal, typically, it's for us, typically it's a commercial piece of software that we think can have a lot of value in the open source world and can create the snowball effect. And typically it's, you know, something that we believe can gather a lot of people around that piece of software. So my part of my job is to make sure we build communities around those things. Right, Eclipse plugins or ADF components or, you know, JSF component, whatever they are, JPA, you know, stuff that we donated to Glassfish and Sun is helping us a lot there. So that's one thing. And typically what we do to increase our chances to build a community around those projects is stuff that's not fun to work on, stuff that these people out there are not going to work on. So we provide also commercial quality documentation. No one's going to go out and do documentation for, you know, they're going to add features, but they're not going to build, you know, documentation for you. Searchable FAQs, right? Unit tests, you know, things that, you know, and we write books on those things, things that, you know, the community will not necessarily jump on and do right away. We do. And we provide so that, you know, we lower, again, this barrier to entry so that more people come in and we keep them, you know, in the project.
Next over here.
Hi, I'd like to go back to Dan's question. But first of all, I'm Adam Zand, thank you, of account director at Topaz Partners. And I used to work at Schwartz on a fascinating account, the NewSphere account. So one question for Omar, and then I'm going to actually pass it on to the other two panelists. I'm wondering, on the business issue, how threatened is Oracle by MySQL, especially if it gets its transactional capabilities up to speed? And then for the other two panelists, are you at all threatened by companies that can service and, I guess, well, obviously sell LAMP as a package architecture?
Mm-hmm. So that's a good question. MySQL, so if you noticed, from a transactional perspective, the storage engine that today runs MySQL is InnoBase. You know, it's called InnoDB, and we acquired that company out of Finland, which is now an Oracle company subsidiary. And we continue to help, you know, the MySQL community with that storage engine. We haven't changed anything. We didn't change the license. We didn't change the team. They're still contributing to MySQL. And if you noticed, we have been awarded the Partner of the Year, you know, in 2006. The MySQL Partner of the Year was InnoBase and InnoDB and all those things. So there's quite an interesting co-opetition there. Same question could be asked to, you know, IBM with DB2, and I think that we don't serve the same markets. MySQL today, it may be changing as we speak, but the way I've seen MySQL around the world, you know, traveling a lot, is that people use it for, you know, building small applications, building personal applications. And yes, it's building a lot of, you know, critical mass around it. And 98%, I think, of the code still comes from MySQL. So they haven't been able to, haven't been able to really get a lot of development from the community. But is it a threat? I don't think so. I think that you need, databases for all kinds of needs, and you won't see MySQL running, the Homeland Security, databases or servers, or you won't see them in, we tend to be everywhere, right, as far as the database goes. So to be honest, today it's not a threat. We don't know how this is going to change. And one of the questions could be, why are we really helping them, with InnoDB, when they could be seen or perceived as a threat? So the InnoDB thing is interesting. We bought them because we are learning a lot, just like we bought Berkeley DB, by the way, from SleepyCat, or we bought SleepyCat company as a whole. These people know a lot about open source. As Oracle is becoming more serious about, being involved in the open source world, we have a lot to learn from these people. They've built incredible communities. I mean, Berkeley DB is everywhere. It's in Linux, it's in Open LDAP, it's in SendMail, it's in PHP, it's in Python, it's in the kernel, Linux kernel, it's everywhere. It's in thousands of open source projects embedded. So they've built like a huge community. And same thing, we bought them, we didn't change their dual licensing model. We still provide free support to all the Berkeley DB open source community. And when people buy support and dual licensing, they buy the Berkeley DB license. Then we provide commercial quality support as well. So that's, I don't know if I addressed your question, but sort of, right? Because it's still playing out as we speak, this whole MySQL versus Oracle battle. But it's interesting, and one thing it does is it makes us work a lot harder on the database, and it proves that databases are not a commodity. They're really, there's innovation every day in the database, and we have to continue to be the best if we want to leave MySQL behind as it is today.
So I think for Karen and me, you want us to talk a little bit about LAMP. So Linux is cool. I think we took care of that part. All right. Apache is cool. All right. We like that. And just for the record, because I brought up JBoss before and said some people thought it was cool, Apache Geronimo is even cooler. All right. Just want to make that very clear. That's what you should be using. Okay. So that's all right. The P part, the scripting language part, really important. IBM, in particular, in the last year, has done a lot with PHP and Zend. It's my personal philosophy, the right language for the right application. There used to be a ton of language research going on in the 1980s. Really interesting languages. We're starting to see that come back. We're seeing Ruby coming out of Japan, open source language. Look at it. It's going to be really significant for lots of things there. So we're starting to see a lot of innovation come with this. The M word, the MySQL thing. Yeah, I would agree with Omar. If it drives us to do a better job in terms of the databases we create, in terms of features and price points, more to it. Would we have ever produced or given away a database for free? Well, we might have done it if Oracle did it. I think you guys actually did do it first, but you did it after MySQL existed. So it changed the dynamics. It changes, makes us change our code, but also our business models. And that's a fine thing. We may not always like it, but we got to keep moving on these types of things. Omar and I were talking a little bit beforehand about a very simple, actually a blogging type of example. I had noticed where the IBM implementation of our blogs, we used Roller, right, which is written in Java, but with a DB2 backend, which is basically instantaneous, versus my own personal blog, where underneath the covers, and there are lots of variables here, but it happens to use a MySQL one somewhere out there in the ether. There's a big difference, okay? And when you're talking about banks and you're talking about insurance companies and hospitals and things like this, there's a big difference. So I'm sure there are many people who are doing many wonderful things with MySQL, smaller things at a certain category, and there are some people who are doing bigger things as well. But this database world where you have these rock-solid things that run on multiple platforms with the performance and the transaction quality, it's going to be needed and will be around for a very, very long time.
So LAMP It's not, and I think, you know, they didn't exactly say this, but basically the sentiment is the same. It's not really a matter of or, it's a matter of and, right? And I think that's what the major companies in the industry are finally, some took, you know, some companies longer than others, understanding that all of these technologies drive demand, as I mentioned earlier. And making sure, I think one of the other things that open source has done to the business is, as Bob was saying, is changing the business model. But also, it tells the companies to take a very introspective look and to find out what's core to your business. Is it important to make sure that you have, you know, your own tool set or your own database? You know, Sun has kind of said, hey, our core business is not database. We are more than happy to partner with Oracle and IBM on database technology, and we will continue to do that. And so as more technology becomes available free and open source, you have to make those choices internally. Are you going to continue to do that thing that was, you know, your kind of your own baby, your sacred cow, whatever it is? But it's really about the and. Right, all of these technologies have different places in the marketplace, and we all want to be able to service, whether it's LAMP running on Solaris on an Optron box or on our T1000 boxes or services around that. It's creating demand, and we support the infrastructure for that.
My name is Jim Starkey. I've been around the industry for a while. Currently at MySQL. And I'll come back to that. People have talked about open source as if it were one idea. It isn't. It's a large number of intersecting ideas. And I'd like to try and straighten it out to a bit. Open source certainly is, by definition, that the source is available. You can look at it. You can understand how it works. You can understand how it interacts with your software. You can look how it interacts with the operating system. And you can probably move it to different environments. Depending on what the license is, you may have restrictions, you may not. The availability of source is kind of the definitive aspect of open source. The question of whether it's open development or managed development is a different question. Now, everyone here has talked about open development, but it's not the same thing as open source. Not all open source is developed from an open, unmanaged community. My history, I put out many products at DEC. I'm old enough to call it DEC and not digital. I started two or three software companies. I worked on Firebird, which is the open source version of a database system I wrote 20 years ago. And I recently had a closed source database company turned to open source database by acquisition. MySQL is absolutely an open source database company. The source is available. Anybody can follow the development process. You know, nightly base levels are available. But it's a managed development process. It has a managed engineering group. In fact, it's a well-managed engineering process. And I contrast this with the work I did on Firebird, which is an unmanaged or an open development process, and where it tends to be a little bit of chaos and things will break overnight, sometimes unpleasantly. And there's a big difference in the dynamic for how the company works. And we really shouldn't confuse the availability of source, open source, unrestricted open source, with how the development process works. Now, the panel here all work from closed source companies who define it as collaborative development. And, you know, it may be that they're looking for free work. Well, that's okay. But the problems that they have aren't necessarily the problems of the industry. The thing that I'm most interested in is in innovation. And, you know, my question, and this is one that I argue with my open source friends all the time, is can you really innovate in an open source environment? And that's a different topic. But I would like to make that distinction, and I think it's a very important distinction. But for me, the difference in open source is that it radically changes the relationship between a software company and its customers. when you don't have to buy the product to use the product, then you have a different relationship. Now, MySQL, of course, everybody understands, derives its revenue from support. Support and documentation, but mostly support. And if we, it and that requires a very open...
And licensing.
And
dual licensing.
Yeah.
Yes,
part.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, so let me just jump in. I think it's because, you know, we live and breathe this every day. So as, you know, you made your comments, I'm thinking about some of the comments that we made. We're not confusing open source with community governance models. And as we jump from each different community, so Apache has its governance, its license, Mozilla has its governance, its license, Java.net, our open source community, has its own governance and its license, Eclipse, same with Eclipse, and the other major communities. So we're very much aware that the license you choose, as Bob was saying before, what you're building, you know, what kind of project it is, depends on how large your community is going to be. Your license actually also helps in that or hinders it. It depends on what you want, right? If you want a really open license that lets, you know, BSD-style open source license that lets you take the code, do whatever you want with it, you can even go ship it closed source and not contribute anything back, you can do that. That's going to create one type of community versus GPL or LGPL or Sun's open source license, name them. Lots of licenses, lots of different communities, lots of governance, and there is some research that you have to do before you join one of these communities depending upon your project and what you're trying to accomplish.
I think that's right. I mean, yeah, respectfully, the amount of open source we do in the range dwarfs what MySQL does, right? You have one model of how you manage your community. We by no means consider most of the other projects that we're involved in as unmanaged in any way. Linux is amazingly managed. Eclipse is amazingly managed. There are a lot of people who have a lot of issues, frankly, with the MySQL type of community or the JBoss type of community. All right, that it's, you know, we applaud that you're doing it in public, and you are open source. There's no question about that. But it's a very particular, very controlled by one organization type of open source. And more power to you. That's the way you want to do it. That's part of the freedom. So you get to try all these different things, whether it's the organization, whether it's the license or whatever. Some will work, some won't work. But just as Karen said, we've got to deal with every single one of these licenses somewhere. And sure, we have a list we prefer, right? But, you know, if we have to deal with the others, we'll deal with them as well.
Is it okay if we break for a few
sure.
minutes? Yeah, because we've been going for more than an hour and a half. So we're going to break for about 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll come back. Thanks a lot. Okay, we're back from a break. And back here are the Mass Technology Leadership Councils. Open source cluster program about proprietary software company views. And one of the things that came up over and over again at the break from talking to a lot of people, there's the question of, you guys are proprietary software companies also, or more than also in the case of Oracle, I guess, because you don't also sell hardware and some other services that
way.
Yeah,
we are a software company.
Yeah, so the question, but it's for all of you guys. What's the conflict you see your salespeople, the conflict that the salespeople have? There's the question of what real support are you giving to these companies? I mean, you're buying Glue Code, you're buying Sleepy Cat. I mean, are you going to let them grow to where they might end up? What do your salesmen do? Where does open source fit into this? What does it mean to a smaller software developer who has a product? Where does open source fit for them? Besides, we all know that as tools that we all use, open source is great. We all love using somebody else's tools. But in terms of for our bread and butter product and stuff like that, where does that all fit? Did I ask that right?
Does this need to
go on again? Or
It was never turned off?
Just hold it right there.
Perfect. That's why you had this little thing that I took off. Okay, I understand now. It was sort of heavy to move around, but it had a meaning. Perfect. No, got it. I'll try to. Okay, so as far as I guess you're talking about the business aspect here, So we're going to switch from, you know, how cool it is and development processes and so on to the business aspect. And as I said, every sales situation is different. Every account is different. And if open source is in an account, we're going to try to, you know, make sure we marry our stuff with open source. And it tends to work very well. For example, if, you know, people have hundreds of Linux servers on IBM or on Sun, or, you know, what we're going to end up doing is selling a database on Linux, and it's going to work very well because we own more than 80% of that market. We also, you know, if people have JBoss, then fine. We have, you know, whole SOA stack that sits on top of JBoss, right? And it's, again, about marrying. It's the open ecosystem I talked about earlier. As long as you stick to standards, we're happy to work with open source. And we're even going to inject our own open source plugins or whatever, you know, is required to make that customer successful. So, and the attitude, if what you're asking, you know, the attitude is definitely not, oh, there's open source is bad, you know, you should try our stuff, it's much better, and so forth. It's typically trying to, you know, build, you know, what works for the customer. And if, you know, there is a mix of open source and commercial software and free software and all those things, then so be it.
What about in the database world? Because you do have some open source database.
Well, they're really different. Really, really, really different.
Are you going to make them stay different?
So I can talk. Yes, yes, absolutely. They serve different needs. Absolutely. For example, Berkeley DB serves a very specific need. It's in the embedded software, not in the embedded as in devices or mobile. It's in embedded in your application. So if you need an embedded database, then we have three databases just for that. We have Olight, you know, that we've had forever. We bought Times 10, the high-end, super fast, in-memory, you know, embedded database. And we have Berkeley DB that's embedded in, you know, thousands and thousands of applications out there.
Are all three of them open source or just one?
No, only one.
And you get paid for the others?
And the others are, yeah, and you have to pay for, unless you want.
So how do your salespeople handle that in a call?
Well, salespeople try to obviously make the most money. No one here will deny that. So they're trying to maximize what they can get from a customer. Therefore, you know, if it's not, they're going to try to convince the customer to spend some money on Oracle products. And but they're really trained. They know what to say. They know how to marry open source with free software with commercial software, and they'll do the right thing, whatever works for the customer. And you know, I'm not a salesperson, but I know that I talk to them a lot, and they are intrigued, and they want to understand how open source works and how, you know, we can marry it with our stack. And I spend a lot of time doing that.
What I hear that is that, but in general, what it is that you love the open source environment of computing, and you want to make sure that with your products, most of which are proprietary, you work well.
Not proprietary again.
I'm sorry.
We are open standards based.
Open standards based. Well, anybody who has proprietary that isn't open standards is having problems in today's world. Okay. We hear from Denmark, etc.
No, but Flash and PDF are doing fine, even though they're not standards and they're proprietary.
They're now considered more. Well, we'll see. People are building as if they are, but the thing with. So what you're viewing is that you love. You're not saying you have to be on the traditional platforms. You're saying people who are using open source stuff, we acknowledge that's there and we're in that world, but you're still mainly a traditional software company in terms of your products and your licensing of your products.
Absolutely, I'm talking right. for. Right. Oracle here.
I know you're talking for Oracle. No,
yeah, and in my example, and Oracle's example, yes, I'm not going to say we love open source because that would be, you know, a weird statement. Yeah. We know, acknowledge, and embrace open source where appropriate. Okay. We have areas where we think open source makes sense. We have areas where we think open source is not ready yet, and we offer, you know, products to close that gap and add value on top of open source and on top of, you know, competitors, obviously, as well. So we don't love open source. We acknowledge that it's here and it's here to stay, and it makes sense in many areas, but not in all areas. So we do whatever is best for the customer.
So if what's best for the customer is to make Sleepy Cat be much more competitive with some of your other products,
Not much of an overlap. If you understand exactly where Sleepy Cat or Berkeley DB today, Sleepy Cat was a company, doesn't exist right. anymore. But if you understand where it fits in the whole, you know, offering, you know, we have many databases, you will see very clearly that it makes a lot of sense to have that and to continue to make sure that community is vibrant and, you know, and active, and we are doing that. So, but there's not a lot of overlap, obviously, with Oracle Enterprise Edition, for example. There's no overlap whatsoever. It's totally different needs and different markets.
We're going to have to move a little faster. We're going to run out of time. What about IBM?
Okay, so it's
your similar situation.
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, full disclosure, because of the breadth of what we do, we can actually say, well, we may not get money because we open source here, because over on this other place, there's an opportunity for increased money. And in fact, if you look at this as kind of an investment model, I mean, who in their right mind would put, let's say, $100 in the bank, and people say, but you don't have access to that $100. Well, at some period, you get more money out of the bank, and if it's enough money, it was a good idea to do it, right? So in many ways, we can look at open source as an investment if we will reap benefits and revenue elsewhere eventually, and all the usual calculations that can go into that sort of thing. Second point is, you know, we've been talking a lot about the different types of open source and whether you're successful and you make money. The world is littered with millions of proprietary companies, software and otherwise, that no longer exist, that never made much money. So being proprietary or private or whatever is no guarantee that your salespeople will do the right thing and make money, okay? So there, yeah, well, you know, there are lots of parallels, unfortunately, as you look at all these types of things. We take a very pragmatic view of this. We take a portfolio view, as Omar said as well. So when our salespeople go to talk to people, they can offer them a range of options. Sure, we would love to optimize this. That is, any given sale, we would like as much money as possible coming to us. I mean, that's what we do, right? It's what you do as well. But because of this combination, if we can go in and say, well, look, for these departments, you folks really want to use WebSphere CE, that is Geronimo. This makes the most sense for you here. But over here, your needs are a little different, your scalability, the types of hardware you're using. This, we think, makes more sense to use full-blown WebSphere. Now, overall, we have this product, let's say that's WebSphere Extended Deployment, which can manage thousands of servers with different types of graphics and intelligence and things like that. That works in your open source, that works in whatever. So it's very much the right type of product, be it private, proprietary, commercial versus open source, that does the right job. And that's, you know, as I was saying before the break, offers us a lot of more flexibility. Now, translating that to something a salesman can actually make clear to a customer is another thing. So we do a lot of sales education about these types of things. When your head is down, when the quarter ends in 2 weeks, and you're comparing this free thing versus the dollar thing, then you've got other issues. But it's not a done deal by any means. We've not perfected this at all. But I think we're starting to get better at it.
So at Sun, we're taking a completely different approach, which is we open source everything, and everything is free to download. You can go use it. You've heard about Geronimo and JBoss, so I'm going to talk about OpenJava EE. That is the source for the reference implementation for the Java EE5 specification. You will find code from IBM at that site, openjavaee.org. You will find code from Oracle at that site, BEA, and other folks that are generating that technology. That's really the source for the technology. I think, personally, it's very hard in particular instances, not in Omar's case, but in particular instances, to say on one side, the value is in the services, the bits are free, value's in the services, buy services. And on the other side saying, oh, no, over here the value's in the bits. Now, the reason I said Oracle's different is because they don't have a competing to their main software, their main database, they don't have a competing open source alternative. So all these other database examples, it's comparing apples to oranges. So I don't think you guys have, your salespeople don't have that issue. But my, you know, Sun salespeople would have the issue if they're trying to sell an application server and you say, oh, buy the license for the point product application server from Sun, but in JBoss you're buying services, it doesn't work quite so well. Also, Red Hat's a great example, selling the operating system services around the operating system versus selling the actual bits. Those are free to download. So The other point that hasn't come up today is about indemnification. So one of the things that Sun provides, and the other companies do as well, as you license or take a service contract with your freely downloadable software, you know, the companies will protect you from legal indemnification issues.
On certain things.
Well, for Sun, everything that we put out there that we sell and download, which is our entire stack, from our operating system to our middleware stack to our SOA integration stack, all of the CBeyond technology that we acquired last year, all will be open source, and you can download it freely today, use it, but you're not protected.
What is the level of indemnification that you do provide?
So I don't know that on the top of my head. That's, you know, I'm in engineering. I don't know if you guys know that for your companies. But appropriate versus the, you know, amount of contract that you're taking out.
Some versus none. It's some versus the none, which is what you get otherwise.
If you download it for free.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, but we're going to be breaking in a bit, so we don't have too much time. I wanted to get to that one thing I mentioned about licenses. What licenses, anything about the different licenses? I mean, different companies have been using different licenses. You write your Asana writes their own, you know, they write their own, you know, and some people, you know, GPL is used by some of the stuff we're talking about, but Linus put this nice little carve out saying that, by the way, if you call the kernel, that's not considered, you know, being one piece. So the kernel is okay. It's as if it was LGPL. So, but in general, there's this question about GPL, the other different licenses. What are we doing? What do you see about licenses? How does that fit with you? Does it matter to your customers? What do your customers think about different licenses? Have you run into that?
So this is a loaded topic. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one at work, although many of my engineers pretend they're lawyers on a daily basis and interpret all these licenses. For Sun, we created the CDDL license because we had to have a license that was going to coexist with our Java technology distribution license. So when we created Java in 1995, 96, we had licensees, IBM, Oracle, lots of other companies, and we needed to make sure that those two licenses were going to be able to coincide because we've actually licensed our source and then licensed our test kits under particular licenses. I think it really boils down to what you're trying to do, right? If you're trying to just get people to use your stuff, but you don't want anybody to steal it, so to speak, or put it in their product, you would use a different type of license than BSD, for example, right?
So you decide not to go with BSD?
We have a BSD style license, right? So Mozilla, Apache, and CDDL are all very, very similar.
So it's Mozilla style?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think there are, 57 official OSI licenses? 80, whatever. Yeah, and that said, I mean, it almost doesn't make any difference because there are only about 5 or 6 of them that are really used. You know, I mean, well over 90% are accounted for by 5%, by 5 of the licenses.
But you guys are using one of those 5?
We tend to. So we clearly use GPL a lot. Typically, our use of GPL is when we engage in external open source projects that already exist. We have in the past sometimes used GPL for new things we've started. The Eclipse license, which is used quite a bit, evolved from what was originally called the IBM license, then became the Common Public license, and then became the Eclipse license. Once a lot of other people joined into Eclipse, there had to be some changes that people insisted on. That was very much, we consider, an evolution of the license as opposed to let's just do something different, okay?
Is there anything, response from customers where they care about that?
Rarely.
Rarely?
Rarely.
So GPL is not a problem for them?
It depends what they're doing. I mean, if they're installing Linux or whatever, right. Yeah, I mean, if they're doing a lot of coding, then it's different from if they're just running. right? I mean, things like this. You know, so it's runtime versus actual development.
There are big companies whose lawyers tell them, don't touch GPL.
Oh, yeah. There are companies. I mean, I remember talking to one customer that said, well, you know, you may need to have an open source strategy which is greater than don't use it. And they sort of were all nodding like, oh, yeah, that was the easy sort of thing. So it is evolving. We do a lot. I couldn't really quantify because of the sheer contributions we do with Linux in terms of amount of GPL. But certainly we do a lot of Apache. We do a lot of the Eclipse public license and that family as well. Mozilla, we're very involved with Firefox as well. We pick them up. So, as I said, those are the main ones.
So you're basically going with existing projects, and you're just following with whatever they happen to have.
But if we start them, and we've started a lot of projects using Eclipse and Apache and things like this. Now, let me add one point, because I was talking earlier about internally. As you work inside your company, you must keep this code separate. So we are absolutely strict about this type of thing. So as you have repositories, you must not let code go from an Eclipse base into GPL or opposite. So in terms of your internal software management, it's no longer just keeping track of you know, histories and things like this. You must keep this stuff separate. Right? It's not hard to do. If you don't, you're going to have some problems.
So in the case of Oracle, we have never, I think, created a license. So I'm against license proliferation, and the reason why we have 80 licenses in the OSI approved licenses list is because everyone tried to come up with one, and some people had very valid reasons to actually come up with a license, but I think that there's enough out there for us to choose from. And so what we do is exactly what you just said, meaning typically we don't start a foundation, we don't start a project that cannot fit within another foundation or another project. So the Eclipse plugins will typically have the Eclipse license. The JPA donation Java persistence are APIs that we made in Glassfish, which is the EJB3O persistence reference implementation, is CDDL. And the Apache donations we make are Apache version 2 licensed IP. So we don't do that. We tend to just use whatever is out there, and I think there's enough choice for us to just pick one that's most appropriate for the project. And we tend to pick the ones that are more open than not. We avoid GPL. And then the point that Bob made, one second, is very important. We have an example of that. We have people working on the Eclipse plugins, and we have people working on JDev, two competing projects, right? JDeveloper is an IDE, and Eclipse plugins are for Eclipse, right? And they are working on the same features, Java Surfaces, you know, Visual Editor, same thing. They are completely separate. They compete. They have fun doing that. And they don't share code. They don't share. They don't meet. They don't do things together. They don't even go for lunch together. They compete. So it's an interesting, interesting, you know, thing that I wanted to share.
We're gonna end this in a second, but I'm gonna take one more question, and then we're gonna go to Karen. We're actually gonna get a lawyer saying some stuff here, who knows this stuff. So we'll do one lawyer first before that. So this is the lawyer time.
Actually, I'm the web publisher.
Okay. You are, sure.
Andy Updegrove, Gesmer Updegrove, and consortiuminfo.org. Question has to do with the interface between open source and open standards. There was one comment by Peter earlier as if, you know, they both perform the same job. You know, open source, you know, does one thing very well. Open standards does another thing very well. There's a subset of things that they both can do, but they're by no means the same thing. And one of the problems is that people who develop open standards typically have nothing to do with open source, and people who develop open source tend to have nothing to do with open standards. You know, eventually that will change, but right now they're really starting to intersect heavily, or collide heavily, if you will, because there's some things that really don't match very well between the two of them. Open source wants to preserve the right for anyone to change anything, but open standards only work if you don't change certain things. And so you have to get on the open source side people to buy into the value of interoperability and raise not changing these bits to be higher in the hierarchy of things that are important to honor when you're doing your programming. And on the open standard side, of course, if you want to have restrictive license provisions, you can't implement it in open source. So I guess my question is, when you look down the road, as open source becomes more and more pervasive, it becomes more and more important that open source and open standards really do work together. Because if they don't, then instead of having more interoperability, you have less interoperability, and you have the ability of distro vendors to capture their users and have them just as locked in as if they were on a proprietary platform, because none of the apps will run on top of anyone's distro other than theirs. So I guess what my question is, when you sit in your, you know, respective worlds having to work with both of them, what do you see as the big issues, and how do you think they get resolved in getting them both to play nicely in the same sandbox?
Yep. I have a quick answer to that. We don't see any issues because we religiously adhere to standards first. So every open source project we do, I can name the Eclipse plugins, JSF, EJB3O, Bipple, all these things are just implementing standards. And if there's a, you know, a sort of a conflict in the community, oh, should we do this way or that way? If the Java surfaces spec says something, we're going to do it that way. So the difference between, you know, in opinions is how to optimize this, or how do we, you know, scale better, how do we perform better. But it's not like, you know, can we just for this, you know, one time not do it the standard way just to perform better or whatever. We don't even talk about that. It's a no-brainer. It's standards first. So, and nothing will make it into the open source projects that we lead if it's not, you know, compliant with the standards that these plugins or projects are compliant with.
But to get back to your point, it's, you know, there are certainly standards that were created several years ago that have licensing restrictions which make it difficult to do open source, and that's the problem. You can't just say it's a standard, so I'll use it in my open source. In fact, a lot of the licensing that comes out of these classical standards, very much the license was given even for free implementation of that standard, and not to say put it in code and then do whatever the heck you want to do with the code, bring it somewhere else entirely different. So there is a bit of a mismatch legally in terms of licenses there as well. We're starting to see, again, just return quickly to this Denmark thing, they very explicitly called out that there cannot be any restrictions on implementations. Thou shalt use open standards, and these open standards shall not prevent how we go and implement this. This came to a head, and a lot of water has gone under the bridge since then, the beginning of 2005 here in Massachusetts. It wasn't a standard, but it was Microsoft basically trying to give the state of Massachusetts a license for their spec, but that license, down deep in the legalese, prevented GPL implementations. And so the government said, wait a minute, you know, somehow there's this license which you're telling me which software I can and cannot use with my information. So standards represent information, flow of information. Governments are becoming much more specific about license aspects of standards to give them the flexibility if they want to do open source or any otherwise. So there's got to be, you're absolutely right, there's got to be much more attention paid.
Yeah, so in the Java community process, exactly what Bob said, when we started, we weren't thinking about open source. It wasn't what folks were doing with the technology. They were implementing the standards, and so there were license agreements in place that actually prevented it. I mean, I'm not sure we were very conscious of saying, oh, no, you cannot open source all this stuff. And over time, the community, the driving community, the executive members of the Java community process worked very hard with all our attorneys at the respective companies to come up with licensing agreement that would allow you to implement these specifications that come out of the JCP, which is lots of them. And that's probably one of the biggest open standards that you guys are using or developers are using. With 4.5 million Java developers on the planet, they are counting on the implementations of those Java technologies that they are compatible. And we want to make sure that people who are implementing them are able to do that and use an open source license. So it's, you know, another part of the evolution of technology in the marketplace.
Okay, now we go to, we lucked out. We have a sponsor who also knows what they're talking about. So. No. Sometimes the person who you have from the sponsor is interested and is here to learn and stuff like that. But here we actually have somebody who's representing the sponsor, who's actually has helped us a lot in this stuff, and is actually a major contributor in the area, and that's kind of cool. So, Karen,
thanks,
say who you are.
Well, before I take everything off of the Yeah, thanks. Take everything off of the table with me. So first of all, thank you all for coming, because it was kind of you to share your time, because the proprietary companies, as you don't like to be called, but the companies that have a variety of offerings are a very important source of learning in this area, and one that we sometimes ignore because we hear the other side of the story so often. There are only three things I want to say. First of all, we're talking. I'm Karen Copenhaver. I'm from Choate, and I am also closely associated with Black Duck Software. Choate is a law firm, and this is for his purposes. Choate is a law firm, and I've been doing open source for years. The first time I ever did anything on open source, they asked me in an M&A presentation what I wanted to talk about. It was 1997 in February, and I said I want to talk about open source, and they said, why? And I said, believe me, it'll be interesting. But there's three things I want to talk about very briefly. One is, we were talking about there being too many licenses, and I think we're going to fix that. And the reason we're going to fix that is because we're learning how to manage this better. We're learning how to automate it. And as we move into a global environment, we cannot ask the rest of the world to deal with licenses written in English that have to be closely parsed by lawyers. It's just not realistic. So we're going to get it simplified down. There are going to be certain licenses. I agree that there are different reasons for licenses. I agree that there are different licenses that would apply, you know, to specifications that are much more closely associated with trademarks and branding. But we're going to fix this, and we're going to fix it, because this is not just a you know, United States phenomena. This is a global phenomena. The second is that I think the next wave is exactly what you folks were talking about at the end, which is that the customers like, you know, the opportunities that open source presents, but they are looking for the throat to choke. I mean, they are looking for the responsible party. They are looking for the indemnifications. They are looking for, you know, people to stand behind things, and learning how to manage, you know, the open source opportunity and to wrap around it an appropriate commercial offering is going to be a real challenge going forward, and you folks are going to lead the way on that. So I thank you for that. But I think that's the next, is combining this concept of branding and standing behind and having the benefit of open source. And the last thing that I want to say is, you know, my original education, I was an art major, but I was also an economics major. So I really do think about things in terms of sort of economic structures. And we should be asking questions all the time about whether we're structured to encourage the right thing to happen. Like, one of my current concerns about, you know, they asked me a question at the Red Hat Summit about whether I really didn't like patents. You know, are you really that much against patents? And I said, well, let me just put it this way. My concern about patents, and there are probably a variety of them, but my big concern is that when the most money that an engineer can make is going to become a patent lawyer and to be involved in patent litigation, we have the wrong incentives in place. Those people ought to be starting companies. You know, when your most creative person is in your accounting department, that's a problem. When your most creative people are being sucked into litigation and patent lawyers within the United States, we are not looking at ourselves as a global competitor. We are looking at ourselves as playing a game by U.S. rules that nobody else will care about coming forward. The legal tax on doing business in the United States is going to get too high. So I look at things and say, are the incentives right? And here's, you know, as a lawyer, I go back to 69, 70, and believe it or not, I was working at IBM in 78 when we were really figuring out how we were going to protect software. You know, after the unbundling, what were we going to do? You know, and we came up with this concept of protecting software by copyright, and then we came up with this concept that it wasn't really sold, it was licensed, and that gave people the ability to control software all the way through the distribution. That shaped an entire industry, and it gave enormous control in the software industry that no other industry had. I mean, every other industry was subject to aggressive reverse engineering the minute that you released a product. We avoided that for an entire industry for a couple of decades. I mean, we had a very strange set of economic assumptions based around the software industry that were created because of the intellectual property choices that we made. Open source has reintroduced competition to the software industry. And the two things that they said today that, I mean, they said many things that were really interesting, but, you know, it makes us work harder, we innovate every day, and it makes us change our business models and think about the way we do business differently every day. that's an enormous contribution to an industry that was headed. I mean, you think of where we were when the Justice Department started their suit against Microsoft. The industry was frozen because of an inability for people to compete. And nobody worries about that anymore. Nobody worries that there isn't enough competition. Everybody's looking over their shoulder because tomorrow somebody could open source my product. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. We're going to learn how to manage it. You folks are going to lead the way. We needed a few, you know, a few people that had religious fanaticism on their side to drive them to do something that seemed so insane at the time. We need those people. We need everybody. But in terms of taking it to the next level and having it shape a commercial enterprise that is going to be, you know, the future of the software industry in the United States and around the world, that's going to drive innovation, that's going to drive customer benefits, I think it's greatest thing since sliced bread. So I thank you very much, and thank you all for coming.
Thanks. So Bob, you want to say a word or two, and then...
Thank you. I'll make sure I position the mic.
Thank you.
Appropriate. And when is the podcast going to be available?
Probably next week. Right
on. Well, we really
I'll
appreciate...
Put it on my blog.
Yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time to set up the equipment and get us podcasted. And it really... I would encourage you to, once he gets it up, to spread the word, because I think there was a lot of important information communicated today, and I think the panelists deserve a real warm reception, and thank you for participating, so really, really appreciate it. Again, one, a couple of things, really encourage your contributions and involvement. And the Tech Council, I think it's a very important set of programs that we're offering this year. So any time you're willing to take some of your free time and commit, it's always appreciated. And we've got lots of events coming up. You know, encourage you to check the website. And
what's the website?
MassTLC.org. So it's MassTLC.org. And we'll probably have, hyperlinks to the podcast from there too on the website. So, thanks for coming. We really appreciate your support and the great questions and discussion that we had today. And thanks again for our sponsor and Choate Stewart and Choate Hall Stewart. Sorry, I apologize. Thanks again, and have a wonderful day, and all the best to everyone.